Nice to see you, Ms. Eisen.
Thank you, sir.
And Mr. Hayden, we are ready whenever you are. Would you like to reserve any time for rebuttal?
5 minutes, Your Honor.
Yes, sir.
May it please the court, Arthur Emil Zebs was the subject of a revocation proceeding in the Hampton Circuit Court, which he was sentenced to, had a year of his time revoked for the sole reason that he refused to admit to having committed a crime. And I would submit that
the instant crime.
I'm sorry?
The crime that he was convicted of.
Convicted of under an Alford plea, which, of course, I've cited the case law. There is a distinction between a guilty plea and an Alford plea. There can be other reasons. It's not an admission of guilt, the Alford plea. There can be other reasons that a person might accept this plea. It made the other charge, for example, that carried a 20-year sentence, as I believe the minimum, go away. And
the distinction on an Alford plea versus a straight guilty plea is only a distinction that applies at the time the plea is entered, correct?
It can have effects other. For example, in a lawsuit afterwards, persons might enter into an Alford plea, for example, and it would have evidentiary considerations that the person chose not to contest, but it's not an admission of personal guilt. And that's essentially the distinction. He's not contesting the charge, but he's not admitting personal guilt. That's the distinction. I quoted the law there that very clearly states that's what the distinction is. So we have this circumstance here where he's done everything that has been asked of him on probation.
I guess getting to the point, how is this a Fifth Amendment case? He's not refusing to answer.
He's been...
And how does he implicate himself on a crime for which he's already been convicted?
He's being forced to... he's saying, admit that you did this crime or we're going to punish you.
He's already received his... He's already pled to the crime.
He entered an Alford plea. He did not contest
the charge.
That's fine. He entered
an Alford plea.
But he did not admit. Now, it's one thing that if the evidence had been that he pled guilty... Or he'd made statements at other points where he's personally admitting guilt. He can't then try to later on say, now I'm invoking the Fifth Amendment. That would be the situation where it'd be improper. But where he has consistently, always, throughout the proceedings, has either exercised Alford plea or refused to admit guilt, he's entitled to do that. And the Minnesota versus Murphy case that it was quoting language of the Lefkowitz-Turley versus Turley case states that it's been long held that this prohibition, this Fifth Amendment prohibition against compelled confession, not only permits a person to refuse to testify against himself in a criminal trial in which he's a defendant, but privileges him not to answer official questions put to him in any other proceeding, civil or criminal, formal or informal, where the answers might incriminate him in future proceedings.
And
Judge Zecker,
no,
fire away.
Please, after you get that.
So how does this incriminate him if he's already been convicted of the offense?
Well, for example, what he was convicted of was forcible sodomy. But if he admits during the... Well, yeah, when I was with this minor, I proceeded to rape her, and I proceeded to...
But those aren't before
and there
the
was
court.
A second child that was present during the...
But, Mr. Hayden, those aren't before the court. We're talking about the instant offense.
You're creating facts that aren't before us.
I'm simply pointing out that to say that a person has to confess in this situation, there could be...
Could be is not the standard. Let's back up. What was he show cause for?
For refusing to admit that he committed these
the offense for which
right.
he was convicted,
and part of this, actually, what he was specifically violated for was failure to successfully complete the sex offender treatment program, and the sole reason he was ejected from the program was refusing to admit this offense, and part of it was you have to undergo this full disclosure polygraph, where you have to write this sexual autobiography where you admit to all sexual offenses.
None of that was the subject of the show cause, was it? The show cause had to do with him not completing the program because he didn't admit to this particular offense.
And that's what your brief says, and that's what the motion to dismiss.
And what the probation officer admitted on the stand was that until every single person going through the sex offender treatment program, until they admit to undergo the full disclosure polygraph and write the sexual autobiography of all prior sex offenses they've committed.
You just keep jumping around. You're not answering the question. The point is, what was before the court wasn't the sexual history that goes back however many years. The only issue that they issued the show cause was that he got thrown out of the program because he didn't admit to this particular offense.
Well, all right. If we just confine it specifically to did you commit this offense 12, 13 years ago, and he says no. Well, according to the Minnesota versus Murphy case, he has a right to persist in maintaining his innocence, even after conviction. That's what the U.S. Supreme Court has very explicitly stated in a majority opinion twice now.
On a plea of not guilty. Right?
I don't know that, but it may have been. But the point is, they don't distinguish in the Minnesota versus Murphy case whether, a person loses that right if he enters an Alford plea.
Well, they don't have to distinguish it. If it's a plea of not guilty, that's an issue there.
All right.
I keep going back to the language, the Fifth Amendment language that says in future criminal proceedings.
I would note, but they also say in informal proceedings, whether civil or criminal, formal or informal, where answers might incriminate him in future criminal proceedings.
Right. So,
and the POs say that if he says something in the course of this...
just because the POs testify... I mean, it goes back to what Judge Frank was saying. Just because the POs testified about it doesn't mean that that's the basis for the trial court's ruling.
Let's look at the very specific wording of the Minnesota v. Murphy case in the Turley...
Well, I'm very much interested in the answer to Judge Decker's question, where the tail end of what the Fifth Amendment provides is where the answers might incriminate him in future criminal proceedings. Take that in the context of just dealing with the instant offense here, not the sexual autobiography. How does that answer incriminate him as to the instant offense?
I would submit that, certainly his answer denying it has the effect of causing him to lose his liberty, that certainly has an
effect.
But
that's not Fifth Amendment. He didn't just refuse to answer. He didn't admit.
The Fifth Amendment doesn't say that you have a right to decline to answer if you fear that your answer might incriminate you. It doesn't say you've got to prove that you know that the answer would. There's just a flat-out
no, but Minnesota
right.
v. Murphy, which you're relying on, says in future criminal proceedings.
And so, when you're suggesting, well...
For a crime, not the instant case.
I mean, we're not trying to beat up on you, Mr. Hayden.
We're just trying to get
to the bottom of what you're trying to argue.
When you suggest that, well, what proof is there that he might have been prosecuted for his answer? It doesn't matter if he had proof or if he just simply believes it, that's sufficient.
Where's the law on that?
The Fifth Amendment says you have a right to exercise, and you don't have to prove that you were facing incrimination if you choose to exercise your Fifth Amendment.
What we're wondering is how he could have been subject to future prosecution on an offense for which he's already been convicted.
If the appeal time has gone, the habeas corpus is gone.
So the bottom line
is, what is the incrimination if he had answered the question? How did he incriminate himself?
a person has a fundamental right to persist in maintaining their innocence, period. Period. It's a fundamental right each and every one person has, and that's why when they state in the Minnesota case, they say a defendant does not lose this protection by reason of his conviction of a crime. That's all that happened here was a conviction of a crime.
Keep reading that same paragraph.
And it says, it regardless of whether the defendant is imprisoned or on probation at the time he makes the incriminating statements.
If those statements are compelled.
I'm reading on page 40 of my brief. The United States Supreme Court.
I'm reading from the case.
All right. It goes on to say a state may not impose substantial penalties because a witness elects to exercise his Fifth Amendment right not to give incriminating testimony against himself.
The rest of that paragraph says if those statements are compelled, they're inadmissible in a subsequent trial for a crime other than that for which he has been convicted.
I've noted numerous cases that of not only the U.S. Supreme Court, but of the other states that have addressed this issue that indicate that this is a compelled confession. It's a proper. He has a right simply to say, I didn't do it. I know I entered an Alford plea, but I entered the Alford plea for different reasons, and I have a right to persist in saying I didn't do it. And that's it. I mean, that's the right. I'll reserve if I have any time left. I'll reserve.
May it please the court. I think it's very important that we look at why he was revoked. And there is discussion in our transcript from these hearings about full disclosure polygraphs and sexual autobiographies. Those are not the reason that he was revoked. In fact, time and time again in the appendix, we will see, and I start with page 40 to 41, where probation officer Fleisig is talking about full disclosure polygraphs. And curiously, on pages 40 to 41, probation officer Fleisig says, routinely people fail these, and that's not a basis for discharge, because people routinely do not pass these. The autobiography and the is part of treatment. It's not necessarily part of successful completion. The basis of revocation, which is on page 48, when we're winding up this discussion, is his refusal to admit the crime of conviction, the one he had already been convicted of. And then, when we come back in June, and now Mr. Berriman is the probation officer instead of Mr. Fleisig, and he says the only reason, page 116, is the refusal to admit the crime of conviction. Again, there is some discussion of this full disclosure polygraph, and the prosecutor notes that's not the basis of why we're here. And in fact, on page 123 of the appendix, the court appears to be losing his patience just a little bit, says, it seems we get to this point every time. No. The sexual autobiography, the full disclosure, not the basis of the revocation in this case. It is only the crime of conviction. The crime of conviction where, as Judge Frank noted, the appeal time had gone by and the time for a habeas had expired. I would also add,
Plus, he couldn't be charged with perjury.
He could not. That was the very next thing I was going to go to, because in distinguishing the cases that counsel cited in his brief, it's important to note that all of those cases either involve a defendant who still had a post-conviction ability. And the reason that's important is there could be a new trial. And if there's a new trial, there would be some risk that this statement could be used against him. Or one of those cases involved someone who did testify and could therefore be charged with perjury. We don't have that in this case. And so what we have in this case is no possibility of incrimination. There are two prongs to this test. Prong one is incrimination. Prong two is compulsion, that there is some penalty that will be suffered. We don't need to discuss both prongs. I know in my brief I cited a habeas case because how infrequently I actually get to cite habeas cases in a direct appeal brief. But it's like Strickland versus Washington in an ineffective claim. You have to be able to prove both prongs. And if you can't prove one of them, then that is the end of the inquiry. The defendant in this case cannot prove the incrimination. That is the end of the inquiry for this case.
Counsel, can you address just briefly Mr. Hayden's distinction between an Alford plea and a guilty plea and why you believe that's insignificant?
It is insignificant in this case, and I can't do it nearly as well as the Virginia Supreme Court former Chief Justice Carrico wrote in Carroll versus Commonwealth. When the issue in Carroll was not a Fifth Amendment issue, but the argument in Carroll was you can't revoke my probation when I won't admit my crime when I entered an Alford plea. And the Supreme Court said that, yes, you can. And this is what the opinion says. I'm going to read it. It's towards the end of the opinion on, it looks like 652 of the Virginia report, maybe 420 of Southeast 2nd. And the chief, former chief said, he can maintain his innocence at the drugstore, the grocery store, and any public place he desires. But when in the private setting of sex offender counseling that is ordered as a condition of probation and his admission is necessary for rehabilitation, he must admit responsibility for his conduct. So this is in the context of an Alford guilty plea. And when one is asked to plea, to enter a plea at a hearing, at a guilty plea hearing, one can enter a guilty plea pursuant to Alford, but it's a guilty plea. And the difference is when the judge asks the question, are you pleading guilty because you are in fact guilty? The answer is no. I'm pleading guilty because I feel that the Commonwealth's evidence is sufficient to convict me or this is in my best interest or what have you. But the plea is still a guilty plea. And I think that the point that the court, Supreme Court was making in Carroll is that whereas there may be some distinctions in how the plea is entered, after the plea is over, there's nothing in Alford or any of their other cases that address what effect the distinction between an Alford plea and I'm guilty plea has, especially in the context of probation. I do think it's important to remember in this case that the sex offender treatment was not just a condition of probation. It was a part of the suspended sentence. It was part of the plea agreement in this case. The prosecutor in this case read the portion of the plea agreement which called for successful completion of the sex offender treatment. And so we have part of the plea agreement, part of the court's order with the suspended sentence, and a probation requirement. And while initially the trial court in this case held hearings and determined that a violation had been established and did not revoke any time, then following that finding of the court, there were additional hearings and the court did revoke some time. I would point out to this court for whatever informational basis or information there may be, that the initial appeal is still pending in the Virginia Supreme Court in this case. I talked to them yesterday. It hasn't been set for a writ panel, but it is still pending in that court. The original one that this court denied is still pending in the Supreme Court. I do think it's important, and I included it in our brief, that the purpose of suspended sentences, the purpose of probation is remedial. It is a rehabilitative tool. I think it's interesting that both of the probation officers who testified in these hearings noted that. Mr. Berriman noted that it's important to complete the sex offender treatment program to reduce the risk of reoffending. Mr. Fleisig testified of the importance of the admission of the offense for the treatment benefit that the person can receive.
So this case is on direct appeal to the Supreme Court.
The case which this court already ruled on.
The underlying case.
The initial revocation where there was a finding of probation violation but no revoking of the sentence.
I got you.
Yes, sir. So
that wouldn't impact one way or the other, or wouldn't create incriminating position.
Oh, no, sir. No, sir. No, I just bring it up because it's a very unusual position, appellate posture to be in. I would be happy to answer any other questions that the court may have. I would rely on our brief where we distinguish the cases that the defendant has cited and in fact, use some of the cases that he cited because, for instance, one of the cases that he cited from Wisconsin, I think, said this as well as can be said. Where there is no threat of any new criminal consequence from a compelled admission of guilt to a crime of conviction during sex offender treatment, there is no Fifth Amendment violation. That's where we are. There is no Fifth Amendment violation because there is no incrimination. That prong cannot be established in this case.
And because this isn't genuinely a Fifth Amendment issue, the logic of Carroll applies.
The logic of Carroll definitely applies with regard to the Alford plea, and the defendant in this case, Mr. Zebs, cannot stand on that Alford plea and say, because I entered that kind of plea, then you can't require me to admit my crime of conviction. And so with that regard, yes, because the Carroll case doesn't really address a constitutional issue at all, as far as I can see. That is simply did the court err in violating the probation on that basis. This court's decision in Venable didn't reach incrimination because there was the other prong hadn't been established.
If indeed we might be looking very closely to the Venable line, if indeed this involved admission relating to other offenses.
If there was a possibility of admission for other offenses, as some of the cases that the defense counsel cited in this case, then you would.
I think the
incrimination issue then becomes a problem because
right.
If there is the possibility of future criminal prosecution based upon those statements, then that's a whole different set of circumstances. It would be a very different case, but not the one that's before this court. And so we would urge this court, based on the prior precedent, including Minnesota versus Murphy, to affirm the judgment of the Hampton Circuit Court in this case.
Judge Frank, any questions?
Nothing. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Hayden, if memory serves, you've got not quite 4 minutes left for rebuttal.
Yep. Thank you. The Attorney General says the defense counsel cannot prove that he faced a criminal prosecution for his answers, but there's no requirement to reprove it. All the Castigar case cited in my brief, 406 U.S. 441, states the Fifth Amendment protects against any disclosures that the witness reasonably believes could be used in a criminal prosecution or could lead to other evidence that might be used. That's all he has. If he had a belief in this, what he testified to was he feared answer. That's all. He don't have to prove it. It's there. I have no requirement. All he has to do is have a reasonable good faith belief. That's it. And that's it. He has a right to assert.
Where's the evidence of that reasonable belief?
He testified. He says believes that he should not have to confess to something he didn't do, and he just has a fundamental right to exercise the Fifth Amendment privilege.
But I don't think that answers my question.
I submit it to the record when he testifies on the stand.
And I'm asking you, Mr. Hayden, as the person that represents him, where's the evidence that he reasonably believed that he would be subject to future criminal jeopardy if he admitted to it instead of denied?
I pointed out that his testimony at the revocation hearing is that he believed he had a right to exercise his Fifth Amendment right. That's period. He doesn't have to prove he has a right to exercise a right.
You just quoted language that said he has to reasonably believe that it could incriminate himself. or lead to future prosecution. And I'm asking you for where that evidence is, that he had any belief, much less reasonable.
He testified he reasonably believed it could lead to criminal prosecution.
He testified he didn't do it.
That's correct. That's right. And I would note that the
Minnick... That doesn't answer the question. Testifying that he denies it because he didn't do it is not the same thing.
There's absolutely no obligation he has to prove it, period. He doesn't have to put on produce
quote,
any
what
evidence.
What quote did you just read us a minute ago?
The Fifth Amendment protects against any disclosures that the witness reasonably believes could be used. It doesn't say will be used or must be used or could lead to other evidence that might be so used.
So where's his testimony about how it could be used against him?
That's in the revocation. I'm not
so
able
to
cite the specific page of the, of the...
Well, tell us what he said then.
Well,
it would constitute that reasonable belief.
Your Honor, the case law has repeatedly said that when a person...
But I'm talking about what he said, because you're talking about what he reasonably believes, and I'm asking you for what evidence there is that came from his lips that he believed that.
He reasonably believes that the person, each individual in the United States, even after he's been convicted, has a right to remain silent unless he chooses to speak in the unfettered exercise of his own will and to suffer no penalties for such silence.
And he didn't remain silent. He denied.
And the United States Supreme Court observed in the Minnesota versus Murphy case, they made that its decisions of the U.S. Supreme Court made clear that the state could not constitutionally carry out a threat to revoke probation for a legitimate exercise of the Fifth Amendment privilege. And in doing so, the government would be...
We need you to wrap up. We're a little over time now.
Yes, sir. I would submit, in doing so, as the Minnesota case note, the government's imposing a penalty upon an individual who elects to exercise his Fifth Amendment right not to give incriminating testimony against himself. He has a right, period.
Great. Thank you. And as is the tradition of the court, we will come down.